As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. When the sun has set and darkness has fallen, a smoking brazier with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, 'To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates.'"
Thank you. So remember, we're on week 5 of Abraham. We're thinking about him because he's such an important character in the Bible. And in fact, he's the only person who's called a friend of God. Did you know that? He's the only person that's called a friend of God. He's called that in Isaiah 41. And it's particularly important that he is the father of all those who believe, it says in Paul's writings, but also that he's a friend of God. And there's a number of really important things, and we're going to start seeing those as we go ahead, that he's such an important character. And if we understand him, we will understand many things in the New Testament as well. But he's called a friend of God. What makes friendship, what makes someone a friend rather than an acquaintance? You know, because we have lots of acquaintances, don't we? Or probably we do. We've met lots of people. But with a friend, you know each other well, don't you? With an acquaintance, you sort of say, well, I mean, I've met them. You know, because quite often people sort of say, oh, do you know so-and-so? And I'll, because I'm just awkward like that, I'll say, well, I have met them. And even if there's someone that I know quite well, I'll sort of say, well, I know them a bit. Because to be frank, I don't know myself very well. So to start saying I know someone else is ridiculous. But with a friend, there's a depth of knowing, isn't there? That we feel comfortable with our friend in a way that we don't with our acquaintances or with just someone that we work with or who's a neighbour. We're comfortable with them. That we can be ourselves. And with our friends, we value their opinions. Quite often we'll ask for advice. Or even if we don't ask for advice, we welcome their advice when they give it. Because they're our friend. And so even if they say something that we wouldn't have thought of or kind of brings us up short, we know they're our friend. And so they're speaking with our good in mind, aren't they? Because what is it? Well, we trust them. That's really the bottom line, isn't it? We trust them, we like to be with them, and we know them. And so we talk to each other. As friends, we talk to each other about things that you wouldn't talk to an acquaintance about. And there's that kind of thing, that our lives, our society is kind of rigged up in a way that there are some conversations that I will never have with you. Because I don't know you well enough. There are some conversations that I hope that you will never have with me, that perhaps might be only between me and my doctor. If you walked up to me and said, how's your kidneys? Then I'd be like, I beg your pardon, you know, because we don't have that kind of relationship. There are some formal relationships where there's a lot of kind of disclosure. And then there's general relationships where we get to know each other a bit, quite a bit. And then there's those close relationships where we have a friend and we say things to our friend that we wouldn't say to anybody else because there's that depth of relationship. And so the context of this chapter is, you remember that chapter 14, we had Chedorlaomer, we had the armies, it was almost kind of swashbuckling action, wasn't it? You know, that Abraham, the hero, he goes off with his 318 trained men and he unsheaths them and brilliant, and he wins and he comes back and he meets the two kings, and it's all kind of really gung-ho. It's really quite swashbuckling action movie stuff. And yet in chapter 15, the kind of camera pans right in and focuses right down on this conversation between two friends, God and Abraham. And it's quite remarkable. It slows the pace right down, and we're able to eavesdrop on something very personal, but of such incredible consequence for the whole world, for all of us, for the rest of biblical history and world history beyond. And so we get to eavesdrop. And unlike a lot of interactions with God, with Abraham, it's a back and forth conversation. If you look in the Bible, you see that God speaks in verse 1. Abraham replies in verses 2 and 3. God speaks back in verses 4 and 5. Abraham, verse 6. God, verse 7. Abraham, verse 8. And then God, who always gets the last word, and it's always a good word, gets 9 to 21. But there's a back and forthness that you don't often see in people's kind of relationships with God, as recorded in Scripture. And notice that Abraham speaks very freely to God. And we know with kind of hindsight that God considers Abraham to be his friend. And yet there's no sense of over-familiarity. Abraham doesn't kind of go, hey, big buddy, you know. There's none of that, you know, me and God, and I said to God, and God said to me, and, you know. There's none of that kind of horrible, over-familiar disrespect of God. He recognizes that God is holy and majestic. He's God Most High. He's El Shaddai. He's the mighty God who's given him victory, who's protected him, who speaks to him. And yet there's no over familiarity. And one of the things that certainly when I first became a Christian back in the sort of early days of the charismatic movement, there were some really horrible attitudes about me and my big, you know, my big buddy God. Ugh, horrible. You know, we need to recognize that God is God and we are not. And by his grace and mercy, he's brought us into a relationship. And Jesus says, I don't even call you servants. I call you friends. How incredible is that? But we can learn a lot from Abraham and his respect for his holy God. Anyway, moving on. So the context is this. We had this. All action hero Abraham with his men, and he goes and rescues Lot and does all this kind of thing. And he is a hero, but if you've ever spoken to anyone that has come back from the battlefield, particularly if they've got, you know, medals and things like this, and I've met quite a few, they don't find it half as glamorous as the people whose only experience of warfare has been Hollywood. Do you know what I mean? Because they've seen that actually it's frightening, it's dirty, it's unpredictable, and people die. They just die. You know, you go into a battle and you have one image, and you read the tragic things, particularly about people who volunteered for the First World War, and they had an image in their head that was just not true. And the horror and the bleakness and the suffering was something completely different. And so Abraham is not an all-action hero. He's 85 years old. He's been to war. He's seen that you don't win those battles without bloodshed, without danger, without the possibility that something could go wrong and your life could be cut short. And so here he is. He's back. You know, back where he was, back at home, he's won the battle, but he's learned something significant about life. It's pretty fragile, really. And he knows that God has made promises to him, and yet he now kind of goes, do you know what? I'm 85 years old, I'm living in a hostile environment. I am a powerful man. I have got trained men, but things go wrong. You know, a stray arrow or spear can change everything. God's made promises, and if I die, they die with me. And so he has this, he's coming from a place of very much realism, and he says, God, you've made these promises, but I don't have any children. How's this going to happen? And so he starts quite logically thinking, well, I guess it's going to be my servant, because the culture of the day, it would automatically go to his kind of chief steward, his chief servant, and that would be that. And God in verse 4 emphatically says no. The Hebrew is really quite emphatic where he says, no, this will come from your body, from your loins, will share your DNA. These promises are for you, not for him. I could have made promises to him, but I made them to you and to your offspring. And so it's really very clear. God says, no, this is about you and me, not about other people. And he sets about doing business with Abraham in this dialogue. He starts by saying, look up at the stars. Now, I mean, just as an aside, this says something about how healthy Abraham was. 85 years old. You know, my dad, I think, is 85 years old. If he took his glasses off and you said, look at the stars, he'd say, what? In fact, if I took my glasses off, it would probably be the same. But Abraham was obviously in pretty good shape, enough to chase a few armies and enough to be able to count the number of stars in the sky to actually be a challenge, you know, rather than, well, I can see the moon, I think, you know. But God says, this is a promise to you and your offspring. Look up, count the stars. Can you count them? No, you can't. And it also is lifting his vision to what is greater than him. He's saying, I'm the God who made the stars. You can't count them, but I made every single one. I know them all by name. That is not just giving him a challenge to expand his faith numerically, but he's being told to lift his eyes and see the greatness of God. And do you know, when we lift our eyes away from our problems and lift our vision towards God, as we gain that vertical perspective, we find that our problems don't necessarily go away, and they're not going to for Abraham for quite a few years yet, but they come back into perspective, don't they? Those things that when we just fill our vision with them are overwhelming. When we lift up our eyes and see the promises of God, we said, you know, it is a problem, but God is so much bigger. And that's why praise and worship is so important. And because most of us are pretty flaky when it comes to it, that's why we need each other. We need to praise and worship with other people who will kind of, I don't know, we just kind of encourage one another. When we sing, when you sang What a Friend We Have in Jesus, you were singing. And it lifts, it just helps you lift your perspective and focus from those problems that you walked in with. And lift up your eyes and say, what a friend I have in Jesus. And we encourage and strengthen one another as we do that. We need one another. We need to praise and worship. We need to lift our eyes from ourselves and lift them to the God who made the heavens. So God says, trust me. And in verse 6, basically, Abraham says, yes. It says he believed the Lord and God declared him righteous. Why did God declare him righteous? Because he was such a good man? Read the next few chapters. Didn't that? Is it because he was going to get his life together? No. It was because he trusted him. Because Abraham said, yes. I don't know how. I don't know when. But yes. Because he trusted him. And that's how friends are. We trust our friends. Even when a friend says, I'm going to do a thing for you, even if we don't know how, we think, well, they've said it. It's as good as done. I trust them. I mean, think of the alternative. If a friend, or perhaps even a spouse, says, I'm going to do such and such for you. Are you really, though? Are you? I'm not sure that I can believe you. How well is that going to go? Not very well. Not very well. I can promise you, you'll reduce your friendship group quite rapidly if you start distrusting and expressing distrust. The way that we actually deepen that trust and deepen that friendship is by just having simple trust. And how do we do that? When someone says they're going to do a thing, how do we show trust? Before it's even happened, we say thank you. Don't we? They say, I'll do this for you. Thank you. Do we have any evidence? No. Other than our trust, other than our friendship and relationship. And you read Romans 4, and actually, I mean, Paul makes a meal of it. But that's essentially what Romans 4 says. That Abraham trusted God, that he believed, you know, he hoped against hope, and he, you know, the God who calls things that are not as though they were, and all that kind of thing. And he makes a great big thing out of it. But basically, Abraham knew that God could be trusted and said thank you before he'd got the fulfillment. Simple as that. But Romans 4, Galatians 3, James 2, the New Testament writers make it clear that Abraham's trust was in response to God's grace, in response to God's faithfulness, and not in Abraham's ability to make things happen. In a little while, we're going to see how well it goes when Abraham tries to make things happen. He's called Ishmael, and that's another story. But that doesn't work. What we see is why Abraham is called the father of those who believe. Because he said yes to God. He said thank you when God made a promise. And so he showed that trust. And so, having reaffirmed his promise to give Abraham a son, he goes on to talk about the land that he's promised, including something of his time frame, which is a bit of a stretch for poor old Abraham, because he starts talking about hundreds of years, 400 years, and this is going to happen. You kind of go, oh, ay, ay, ay. I had no idea. But of course, God's time frame is bigger than ours. Of course it is. And his purposes are bigger than ours. Of course they are, because they encompass more people than just us. We're not the main event. He is. And so when we realise that we have a part in his plan, rather than sort of saying, oh, it's all about my plan, we actually find that life works better because we want to seek his kingdom and his purposes, not our own. And then he does this incredible thing that having done this and having had a response of trust and a response of yes from Abraham, he goes a step further and he formalizes this promise with a covenant. And he does this incredible thing. And Abraham, he's 85 years old, right? He doesn't know that he's not even middle-aged yet. He lives to 175. He doesn't know that he's not even halfway there. But, you know, nevertheless, God in his mercy formalizes this thing with this thing called a covenant. Now, we've talked about covenants before, about vassal covenants, you know, between sort of protection rackets and making sure that different people work together and they'd have to pay tribute and blah, blah, blah. And these things were formalized with a covenant, which in this instance is a blood covenant. They take a number of animals, they come down the middle, which is not a quick job, mind you. If you think about the practicality of it, rather than just skimming over that verse, this is a morning's work. You know, you've got to find the heifer. You've got to calm the heifer down before you surprise it. And then you've got to cut the thing. And the two sides, other than the birds, are laid either side. And there is a pathway of blood. And what they used to do in the old days is both partners of the covenant, the two sides of the covenant, would walk through this thing. And they would declare the terms of the covenant. They would declare blessings of obedience, of keeping the covenant, and cursings of not keeping the covenant. And then perhaps they'd have a meal, quite often have a meal. Perhaps they'd plant a tree. Perhaps they'd exchange cloaks or belts or swords or different things like that. There were lots of different variations, but that was the essence of it. But the two parties would walk through. But hang on a second. That's not what happens here. You see, only God goes through the pathway of blood because he doesn't want to have a weak party involved, because it's what we've seen before as an unconditional covenant. It relies only on God and God's faithfulness, not on Abraham and Abraham's strength and faithfulness. That's a relief, isn't it? Because Abraham proves himself to be a bit of a flake in a few chapters' time. So God makes this unconditional covenant. There is nothing that Abraham can do to help or hinder And so God does this, and he says, and he reaffirms the covenant. And it's an unconditional covenant. All Abraham has to do is recognize that God has bound himself legally by doing that. And he can be confident that God can be trusted, not just because he's his friend, but he also has this kind of binding agreement. You know, there's another unconditional covenant that springs to mind, exactly the same, where it relies just on the one party and not on the other. And that, of course, is the new covenant, where Jesus paid our debt. Think about what we were saying earlier on. There is nothing else for us to add. It doesn't rely on our strength or faithfulness. It relies entirely on what he has done for us. When Jesus on the cross cried out, "It is finished," tetelestai, it's saying it's paid in full. It is completely dealt with. There is nothing for you to add. There is no additional payment. And so think about our envelopes earlier on. There is no, Jesus has paid our debt. There is nothing else for us to pay. We are brought into a new covenant with God because of what he has done. That new and living way. He walked that path for us before we were even born. But we were in the heart and mind of God when he did it. We're actually going to think about that a little bit more tonight when we look at the cross. So, that's probably enough content for this morning, but I want to just sort of say, tomorrow morning when you wake up, you know that Monday morning feeling? It's the opposite of the crunchy feeling. Thank crunchy, it's Friday. You know the, do you remember those adverts? Maybe not. Tomorrow morning when you wake up and you feel a bit bleh, you know, what difference does it make what we've heard about being a friend of God? What difference does it make knowing that we're in an unconditional, this new covenant with God? What difference does it make? Well, first of all, God is our friend. Jesus said, "I don't call you servants, I call you friends." I mean, that is enough to kind of blow your mind for the next 20 weeks. But just think, God is our friend, and just like Abraham, when he's come back from this thing and he's unsettled, and he's kind of a little bit stirred up, and he's aware of his weakness, he's aware of his mortality, God, our friend, calms our fears. He understands our questions. And what's his answer? He says, "Do not be afraid. I'll protect you, and I will be with you. I won't ever leave you. I will protect you." We started by singing, "The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run into it, and they are saved." He's our friend. When you're afraid, when you're doubting, when things are too much, run towards him. Please don't run away from him. Please don't blame him for what others have done. Run to him and find safety. Find friendship. Find a calming for your fears. And God, our friend, knows when to bless and when to delay. You know, he said this thing about 400 years. But God's timing is perfect. He sees those things that we don't. He knows that sometimes we would spoil his blessing if we got it when we want it rather than when it's right to give it. Because sometimes, I know this might not sound great, but we're not mature enough. It's actually true. You know, I guess Jamie Oliver's parents could see this budding chef, but if they'd given him a kitchen knife when he was 2 years old, that would have been reckless, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? So what is a blessing later in life? He can do carrots and all sorts. When he was 2 years old, when he wasn't mature enough, it would have been fingers, wouldn't it? And so sometimes we're just not mature enough. We're just not ready. And so God, in his love, holds a blessing to the right time. And we need to trust him for that. And in the waiting, we find that we grow. In the waiting, we find that we trust him more, or we have the opportunity to trust him more. And when the promise is fulfilled, it's at just the right time and in just the right way. And it's for our good and for his glory. And we thank him for it because we know that he was right. Big surprise. God was right. What's next? God, our friend, wants us to trust him. He loves it when we believe him. We demonstrate our trust in his goodness when we trust him like a child. I mean, how awful would it be if you went to sort of pat your child on the head and they flinched as though you always hit them? I mean, what would people think? Or if you said to your child, I've got some sweets for you at home, it's like, you never get me sweets. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. You never do. If our children said that to us, we'd think, oh my word, what have I done? What a disaster. How do you think it is to the heart of our Father God when we act in distrust? When we assume that what he's doing is to punish us or to be mean to us or to withhold blessing? Quite the opposite. He loves us and what he wants for us is best. And when we recognize that, we say thank you, don't we? So just like the child, when you say to your child, when we get home, we'll have some custard pies. Thank you. That's the right reaction, isn't it? And so we actually bring glory to God when we live trusting, when we live content, rather than expressing distrust. And God, our friend, wants us to live without fear. When conditions appear grim, when a situation looks like it's going to overwhelm us with doubt or fear or disillusionment or even depression, God wants us to trust in his unchanging character. Do you know, circumstances change. God does not. That's really important. Circumstances change. Things change, don't they? People change. God does not. We can always rely on him. He is our rock. He is our fortress. We can always rely on him, no matter what else is going on in our lives. Because God, our friend, has plans for our good and not for our evil. You know the verse in Jeremiah 29. I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for good and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Let's live with that positive anticipation and confidence in our good God. He loves us. Let's relax into that. And you know, we don't even have to endure the waiting alone, because he said, I'm always with you. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. So even while we're waiting for that promise to come, even while we're waiting for those circumstances to change, God, our friend, is with us. And that makes all the difference. So tomorrow morning, if you wake up feeling blah, just say to yourself, God is with me. God is for me. God is my friend, and I can trust him. It will change your Monday for the better.